Hello everyone. It's been a while since I posted a video. My apologies for that. Move this a little closer. My body's getting old and tired and causing me some obstacles. And I would rather speak to you from a place of clarity and the best health that I can have anyway. So, without further ado, Namu Myoho Renge Kyo, Namu Myoho Renge Kyo, Namu Myoho Renge Kyo. I would like to discuss, or at least begin the discussion, on the Diamond Sutra, or the Prajnaparamita Sutra, or the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra. I've read the Perfection of Wisdom in 8,000 lines. I also have a complete translation by Kanzi, which I recommend. Is really beautiful. It's a sizable sutra, so it will take a while to digest. It's a very important Mahayana sutra, and if you're interested in the scholarship of Buddhism, as I am, excuse me, terrible. I would highly recommend this book. It takes apart the sutra stanza by stanza and gives you background from several Chinese scholars as well as Indian scholars and commentary by Red Pine himself. It's translated from the Sanskrit and the Chinese. It's very thorough insights and explanation of what's going on in each stanza. I think it's important not only for the Diamond Sutra, but to read a book like this, as well as the others, so that you can read it for yourself in its entirety in the prose that was common to the era of Shakyamuni Buddha and soon after in the scholarship. I've repeated many, many times that what's important, and I'm just parroting Shakyamuni's own words, like in the Lankavatara Sutra, he very strongly admonishes his students to not get bogged down in the words of his teaching, but to look for the merit in the words, for their meaning, for what he's driving at. And I'm impressed once again as I read this book of scholarship on the Diamond Sutra, on the a significant mode of the Buddha's or Shakyamuni Buddha's teachings throughout his entire teaching life of 50 some years. In a way, it's created some confusion, unfortunately. Only because, you know, we're humans and we tend to get attached to something, and once we get attached to it, we don't hear anything else. And so it's kind of like teaching math to students. You'll have to start with the concept of numbers and then how you manipulate those numbers, addition, subtraction, then multiplication, division, and then the world of fractions. And, you know, a lot of people stop there. That's it. That's all the math. That's math. That's what I know is math. That's what I struggle with in school or whatever. And that's all the math I'll ever need to know, blah, 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 and that's it. Some students are more curious about, well, what else can I do with these numbers and these functions? And they go on to algebra, geometry, and some find that to solve everything they need to know. And they consider themselves superior to the mathematics people, but at the same time, and they would say algebra, geometry, and trigonometry are far more advanced. And they'd be right. And then we follow that up with maybe calculus, and maybe you get all the way to quantum, and a whole lot much larger field of mathematics that penetrates many other fields of science and human curiosity and investigation. To say that each one is superior to the one before is not an incorrect statement, because it's only when you get up into those higher past calculus, into theoretical and chemistry, particle physics, quantum theory, quantum mechanics, so on and so forth, that you finally find some of the ultimate uses of addition, subtraction, fractions, functions, so on and so forth. Because by that time, mathematics has become an actual language of description rather than a tool for everyday tasks. Shakyamuni Buddha taught Buddhism this way because he had to. Because the people of his time just weren't, when he first taught, the first sermon he spoke, the Avatamsaka Sutra, the Flower Garland Sutra, the Kigon Sutra, it goes by many names depending on language and cultures and so on. The Saddhampundarika Sutra, Saddharma Pundarika Sutra, I'm sorry. That's the Lotus Sutra. I got off track. His first sermon, he only taught for 22 days. Wherever he taught it, no matter who he spoke to about it, they just, what are you talking about? They just couldn't get it. They didn't have the capacity to understand. And that's when I'm sure Shakyamuni reflected on his own enlightenment and understood that he learned from the current day Brahmins and these very highest caste of learning and language and so forth, and none of it worked. I mean, he went through the austerities, he went through all these other things, and it wasn't until he, on his own, splintered off and meditated on his own liberation from earthly sufferings that he attained sudden enlightenment, that he suddenly became clear to him what the whole nature of the problem was, and developed a method to say, okay, not only can I describe what it is to be enlightened, like he does in the Avatamsaka Sutra, but he can start to elevate people's capacity to simply grasp some of the ideas that would lead to them being able to grasp ever deeper and more perceptive ideas as he went along for close, about 50 years or so. He had five distinct periods of teaching. What that means is elementary school, junior high, high school, grad school, and post grad. His levels of math, algebra, trig, calculus, on into quantum. So it's important to understand that in some way, because his teachings for the first few periods of his teaching were not the teachings he wanted to teach on what enlightenment was and how to get there. It was teaching in order to raise the capacity of the disciples he spoke to so that they would be prepared to understand the ultimate teaching. Now, because the earliest teachings that he spent 20, 30, 40 years of his life going through stages teaching people, spread very quickly, even outside of India, into Burma, into what's now, what's it called now? There's all kinds of strife going on there right now. Myanmar, Vietnam, and other places. And he taught those for many years. I think the first of his teachings after the Avatamsaka Sutra, I think he taught for 22 years. It took a long time to get people's capacity up to where, oh, I get it. Okay, you get it, but now that's only going to help you get this. And then he moved on to the next. Okay. Well, 20 years or so is a long time. So those early teachings spread far and wide with the impression that this was it. This was the Buddhist teaching. So you have a lot of sects in many countries that never went beyond that. They got to algebra and said, done, this is it, this is the answer, this is beautiful, this is amazing. But they don't realize that they didn't get to the ultimate teaching. They're only in the process of. And so I get asked a lot about, where can I find a monastery or anyway, on that line. And monastic practice just isn't effective at all anymore. By the Shakyamuni's own predictions that the fifth 500 year period after his nirvana, after his departure, there would then come these scholars that would be able to really understand the meaning of his teachings and spread the meaning of his teachings far and wide. He knew that it would take 500 year periods before people had the natural ability to get what he was teaching. That's a long time. I say all of this because the importance of the Diamond Sutra, the Prajnaparamita Sutra, and it's, there's a whole sect of Buddhism that finds that the Prajnaparamita Sutra is one of their foundational texts, teachings, and that's Chan or Zen in Japan. And that's probably the first sect of Buddhism that was recognized broadly in the United States or the West. And it's, it's an early Mahayana teaching, but there are still people. It's like I watch an hour and a half lecture by Thich Nhat Hanh, who is quite respected in the world, talk about the Diamond Sutra, and he completely avoids or misses or intentionally does not see what is clearly a conversation between the Buddha, Shakyamuni, and an arhat or an arhant, Shubhuti. Shubhuti is a Hinayana Buddhist when he starts in the beginning of this book, this sutra. And because of his teaching method, Shakyamuni starts step by step, little by little, expanding and changing the wording and slowly bringing this arhat around to understand that what he believes he is and what he is practicing as the ultimate teaching falls way, way, way short of the ultimate teaching. This is why it's called Hinayana Buddhism, because it means lesser vehicle. It means you're only ready to learn. It's like getting a black belt in martial arts. It doesn't make you expert. What it makes you is conscious of what you can and can't do. So now, as a great teacher of mine told me many, many years ago, now that you have a black belt, that means that you are ready to learn. You don't know yet. You're just ready to learn. That's significant. And this is as far as Hinayana Buddhists go, Theravada, Tripitaka, whatever label you want to give it. These people have stopped at Arhat. It's also something else Buddha constantly hammers on and evolves throughout the book is the concept of self and no self. This is where Hinayanas are stuck, because they're stuck on, like Zen, the whole concept of emptiness. You hear that all the time if you study or listen to any Buddhist orators. you hear must learn emptiness. Well, this comes through Zen, but it's through all of the early teachings. The concept that we, I, life, rebirth, pay attention to that word, rebirth, that these are all attachments that cause our failings and suffering in life. Therefore, the objective in Hinayana Buddhism is to release yourself from the concept of self, life, soul. But what Shakyamuni points out is that if your ultimate goal is to realize no self, no life, no body, no soul, then you're just as attached as you were from the very start. You haven't gotten there. Because if your belief is based on the negation of something, then you are still attached to the idea that there is something. You see? If I say there is no ball in this room, it's because I'm referencing ball, something that I know exists, therefore I have to look around this room and say, it does not exist here. To say it does not exist is to, by default, claim that it does. So you haven't gone anywhere. Whereas in the Bodhisattva practice of Mahayana Buddhism, the idea is not of no rebirth, but of no birth at all. Okay, I'm letting that sink in. What I'm saying to you is that the entire Prajnaparamita Sutra is called the Wisdom Sutra or the Diamond Sutra because it's about the mind. And in fact, as I've said in previous talks, Buddha is not a person. Buddha is not a destination. Buddha is not something we try to reach. Buddha does not exist. What does exist is the mind. And the mind exists in this condition of samsara. So the Buddha is a state of that mind of realization that all is from the mind. And I'll quote this book. Where he says it, where commentaries on this, and this is what I like most, is there's a lot of Indian Chinese scholarship that interprets these passages of the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra, and they make it abundantly clear that that where there is no mind, there is no Buddha. Where there is Buddha, there is mind. Because this is about the constructs in the mind. If it helps, if you're a movie buff, I don't want to minimize this, but if it helps as a visual, think of the last of the episodes of The Matrix, where everything becomes just digitized. It's, I'll admit, a very human and flawed analogy, but it does illustrate in a way what's going on? Because, as if you'll remember, not only do the walls in the building just digitize, but the people, as well as Neo himself, are also digitized. In other words, it's all the same stuff. It's a construct. Yes? All right, now, I think maybe I should just start reading the book, but. One last statement before we get going. The entire Prajnaparamita Sutra is this conversation between Buddha Shakyamuni and Subhuti. And we watch throughout the book Subhuti's perception of his arhatship change from a completely fully enlightened practicant to one who has to shift his entire life's practice to realize that he is now only on the road to enlightenment. It's like the guy that gets a, or gal who gets a black belt thinking they're it, suddenly realizing that the only thing they are is capable of working toward it. It's humbling. It's humbling and it's extremely eye-opening. Your whole world changes when you figure that out. How Hinayana scholars can talk about this teaching without getting that out of it? That's the whole teaching. This entire teaching is a conversation to Hinayana Buddhists that you're not there. That the ultimate practice, the practice that I started out wanting to teach you, and the practice that you're supposed to be working toward, has completely eluded you. And here it is. I'm going to show you step by step by step how the Mahayana teaching of Bodhisattva practice is much more immense than anything you've asked of yourself thus far. So it upsets me. I'm a little emotional about it, and I apologize. I'm still human after all. That this wonderful transitional teaching is being so misinterpreted. And I have to believe it's out of ego. It's avarice for, like that guy with the new black belt, thinks he's the one, the it. Hinayanas are like that, and it upsets me because that practice has been dead for thousands of years, and yet they keep it alive today. So that's what motivates me to talk to you about this, because I'm not asking you to believe my own words. I'm going to read them right out of the text. Okay? So let's start. Right in the beginning, I've got a few pages marked here because they're very interesting. Now, this is at the very beginning. See how few pages? Okay. At the very beginning of the book, which chapter is this? Probably one or two. Okay, one, two. Okay, anyway. So this is where the starting point is. For all such beings as these, Subhuti, likewise wear enlightenment upon their shoulders. That's a statement about the body was used a lot in the early teachings. So the mental capacity, the mind of the regular human was from the shoulders down. Very earthly, very functional, very utilitarian. And the mind of enlightenment was considered above the shoulders. Again, the mind. And how so, Subhuti? This Dharma teaching cannot be heard by beings of lesser aspiration, Hinayana. Not by those who mistakenly perceive a self, nor by those who mistakenly perceive a being, a life, or a soul. For beings who lack the Bodhisattva's aspiration cannot hear, grasp, memorize, recite, or master this Dharma teaching. So we're going to start teaching you now. Moreover, Subhuti, wherever this sutra is explained, that place shall be honored. Whether in the realm of devas, humans, or asuras, that place shall be honored with prostrations and circumambulations. That place shall be like a stupa. So he's telling them right now, what you're about to learn is so profound and so essential that wherever it's taught, spoken about, recited, written down, shared, taught to others, in other words, that place shall be no different than the honored place of a stupa, where the relics of Buddha are supposed to be, and anyway, venerated. So, we get into it. I'm not going to read the whole thing, that's up to you to do, but there are certain passages that jumped out at me and I thought would help you see the progression and understand a little bit more about Buddhism. The form of this book is that a stanza or a passage or a chapter, if you will be written down so you can read the whole thing. And then as you progress through the book, chunks of it are repeated, and then scholarship follows about what this means. Again, I love the form of this book. So this stanza says, and why not? Because Subhuti, if these fearless bodhisattvas created the perception of a dharma, they would be attached to a self, a being, a life, and a soul. Likewise, if they created the perception of no dharma, they would be attached to a self, a being, a life, and a soul. This is what I was saying earlier. To negate something or to believe in something. Let's start there. To believe something exists at all, like a dharma, is to be deluded. You can hear the dharma, but this is a state of mind, not a state of existence, not a state of reality. It's a perceptive change. Okay? And so the dharma, the conceptualization and language and explanation put around that event, it's nothing. It's just words. It has no substance of its own. What it points to has some effect, but the explanation or the dharma, some people reduce it to teaching, but it's more than that. It's a state of mind, a perceptive skill. To say it exists is to give it an atomic reality. Do you see what I'm saying? Like it has a perpetual existence. It doesn't. It's only a state of mind that is experienced. And if you believe it exists as something, then you're missing it. And if you say, oh, well, I can't do that, I have to know that it doesn't exist as something, you're doing the same thing. You're just creating a more complicated path to the same perceptive incorrectness. This will make more sense, I hope, as we go on. Huang Po, a Chinese scholar, says, Buddhas and beings share one and the same mind. Otherwise, they don't differ. This mind has never had any form or characteristics. It has never been created. It has never been destroyed. Thus, it is right here. If you think about it, you miss it. It's like the sky. It has no borders. Only this one mind in the Buddha. Buddhas and beings aren't different. However, beings are attached to seeking perceptions outside of themselves. But the more they seek, the more they get lost. They send a Buddha to find a Buddha. Because Buddha's, it's your mind. They use the mind to chase the mind. Like Buddha is something other, which is our great samsaric disease. They can exhaust themselves for kalpas, but they'll never succeed. They don't realize that when they put an end to thoughts and reasoning, the Buddha will appear before them. It's already there. It's just clouded by all of this desire for perceiving other, anything other. This mind is the Buddha. The Buddha is an ordinary being. When it's an ordinary being, this mind doesn't contract. When it's a Buddha, it doesn't expand. When it meets conditions, it acts. When conditions end, it stops. It does not need to be pinned down or realized. It is already perfect. If you aren't willing to believe that this is the Buddha, even if you cultivate for countless kalpas, you will never reach the way. To cling to the perception of a dharma means that a dharma exists outside the mind. Hence, you are attached to perceptions. Whether you do evil or do good, you are attached to perceptions. When you do evil while attached to perceptions, you waste your rebirth. And I've talked about birth and rebirth before. Rebirth is a moment-to-moment activity. We are not extant. We are moments of manifesting our karma, one followed by another. Just like in mathematics, a line is a locus of points. What are points in mathematics? Points are just locations. They're not something. Okay? When you do good while attached to perceptions, you waste your hardships. Neither can compare with recognizing your own mind right now. So don't perceive things outside of your mind. Come to rest with your mind itself. How do you think? Why do you think? What do you think? Those are the things that when we meditate, we try to clear up, purify, get rid of. Not get rid of in the sense of stop doing that, you're bad, but to see profoundly beneath the covers, beyond the descriptions, beyond what this condition of samsara keeps pushing at us. Just wade through it like water. Okay? Not a denial, a going beyond. To watch the function of your mind. This is what meditation is truly about. Because it's a meditation on the meaning of the Buddha's words. Not the words themselves. Outside this mind, there are no dharmas. This mind is the dharma. Outside this dharma, there is no mind. You can use the mind to eliminate the mind, but the mind still exists. And to cling to the perception of no dharmas means to allow perceptions of attachment and non-attachment, good and bad, mortal and sage, to continue to exist. Now you see, we're into the sutra ways here. So, Subhuti's education is starting to get more, what shall I say, thorough. Here in Chapter 9, while Subhuti reconsiders the nature of enlightenment and the origin of sages, the Buddha asks him about the four stages of practice through which Subhuti and his fellow Sravakas, Hinayana, have passed on their way to sagehood. How'd you get to this ultimate place, Subhuti? As their names make clear, all four reflect a concern with ending the cycle of birth and death. But if these would-be sages succeeded in not being reborn, how then could they arise from the uncreated? Such a goal is sterile. There is no compassion in Subhuti's path. Despite its emphasis on detachment, it is self-centered, not being-centered. The Sravaka's quest for no rebirth is not the same as the Bodhisattva's realization of no birth. The difference is profound. Sravakas dam the river, Bodhisattvas swallow it at its source. Again, it's more specific, but it's still kind of poetic. This is what I was saying was about seeing beyond the mere terminology or perception to see through it, beyond its construct, beyond the matrix. What is it? It is here. It's me. It's Buddha. It's my mind. Now, I'm not going to read the whole thing, so I hope this jumping around doesn't confuse you, but I want to show a pattern here. Let's see. Yeah, this is in chapter 10. The Buddha said, Subhuti, what do you think? Did the Tathagata obtain any such dharma in the presence of Dipankara Tathagata, the Arhan, the fully enlightened one? Subhuti replied, no, indeed, Bhagavan, the Tathagata did not obtain any such dharma in the presence of Dipankara Tathagata, the Arhan, the fully enlightened one. Dipankara, in the historical lore of Buddhism, was the enlightened sage that predicted Shakyamuni's Buddhahood. So here he's saying, do you think I received Buddhahood from him? Or instructions on Buddhahood from him? No. Subhuti's starting to get this. Because the Dharma is a condition, an experience. It's not a thing. It's not a description of a thing. It's not a way to a thing. It's the thing itself, which is not created. It's the mind. It's just the energy, as I've described elsewhere. But I'm going to stick with the rhetoric here, because I think you'll get it. Chen Xiong, I hope I'm saying that right. Some of these names are a little challenging for a French-Canadian English boy here. Is it possible he did not obtain any dharma? It was simply that he was not attached to the thought that he obtained anything. The Buddha thinks that his disciples have not yet rid themselves of such thoughts. See, this is dancing around the same thing. If you have thoughts about Dharma existing, then you are still projecting reality outside of yourself. You're not just sitting in your own mind. You're perceiving other. And that's the affliction of the human condition at its base. Hui Neng says, Subhuti is saying that the Dharma needs a teacher to explain, but does not itself contain anything that one learns. The Dharma of the Tathagata is like the sunlight. It shines everywhere, but it cannot be grasped. That's pretty good definition. Li Wenhui says, Pai Chuyui once asked Zen Master Kuan, if we cultivate nothing and realize nothing, how are we different from ordinary people? Master Kuan said, ordinary people are deluded and followers of the two vehicles are attached. The two vehicles being the Sravakas, the Hinayana. To be free of these two defects is true cultivation. Those who truly cultivate are not overzealous, nor are they remiss. To be overzealous is to approach those who are attached. To be remiss is to fall in with those who are deluded. All right, I'm going to go on. you start to see that the repetition is taking forms in different interpretations. But I enjoy that scholarship because they sometimes use words that are more familiar to us modern folk, and they conceptualize the meaning in their own words. And by reading their commentary, you receive the echo of the meaning without getting lost in specific words, because they're all different words, but they're all talking around the same thing. It's like a famous quote that Bruce Lee used in one of his movies, or maybe more than one, and in interviews as well. It's an old Buddhist simile about pointing at the moon. If your focus is on the finger, you miss all that heavenly glory, in Bruce Lee's words. And this comes from Buddhism. Anyway, I don't know why I felt that, throw that in, but that's just another set of words talking about this meaning. Subhuti, what do you think? Is there any such dharma spoken by the Tathagata? Subhuti said, no, indeed, Bhagavan, there is no such dharma spoken by the Tathagata. He's starting to understand that the words are meaningless unless you seek for the meaning of the words. The words will distract you and take you away. Subhuti had said nothing, and that he had heard nothing. Subhuti praised his understanding as constituting true prajna, true wisdom, and this is the True Wisdom Sutra. In The Perfection of Wisdom in 18,000 Lines, Subhuti tells the gods, quote, in the perfection of wisdom, not even a single word has been spoken. Since it has not been spoken, it cannot be heard. And since it has not been heard, it cannot be understood. For the perfection of wisdom is not to be found in words. Here it is again. Thus, it cannot be realized, heard, or explained. The enlightenment of the Tathagata does not reside in words. How much more specific does this need to be? Li Wenhui says, since all dharmas are basically empty, in other words, uncreated, they don't have an existence of their own, what dharma can we talk about? Because it's an experience in your mind. How can you talk about that? By entering the world of conversation and putting an experience into words, you've already attached yourself to something other. This is what is meant here. But followers of the two vehicles, the Shravakas and the Pratyeka Buddhas of the Hinayana, his words, not mine, are attached to the existence of beings and dharmas and think there is something that is proclaimed. Meanwhile, bodhisattvas understand that the beings and dharmas are empty and that there is nothing proclaimed. Thus, the sutra says, if someone says there is a dharma proclaimed by the Tathagata, that person maligns the Buddha. Sheng Yi says, as long as there is a mind, there is a dharma, and then there is something said. But since the dharmas of the Tathagata are empty, his mind is also empty. So how could the Tathagata proclaim any dharma? Tao Yuan says, there is no dharma proclaimed that does not occur in response to some condition. But dharmas that arise due to conditions have no nature of their own and are essentially empty. This book, I mean, the more you read and study all of the sutras, this underlying theme is almost, it's almost like this recurring little itch that you feel that you can't seem to get rid of. It's always there, reminding you that what you're reading isn't what it's about. A lot of people get confused by that, and this is why I think that the Buddha spent so much time, Shakyamuni, when I say Buddha, I'm referring to Shakyamuni, the teacher, who was actually a bodhisattva. If you think of it that way, you'll understand it better, that Buddha, the name that's attached to him, is really about the mind of a bodhisattva, operating with the clarity of Buddha wisdom, his Buddhahood, his choice to stay and help others get there. It is what makes him a bodhisattva. You understand? Terms can get confusing. But I think when we talk about the Buddha said and the Buddha this and the Buddha that, it confuses what's really happening. Because we're all Buddha, because we're all mind. As long as there's mind, there's Buddha. As long as there's Buddha, there's mind. Okay? This is why when your body expires, is not when you become a Buddha. Nirvana is not somewhere you get, it's somewhere you leave. There's just quiescent energy. We're gone. We, this condition of samsara, no longer exists. And without samsara, guess what? You need no mind. So Buddha is a condition of our mind while we're here and now extant in this life. Remember, I've said it a million times, Shakyamuni Buddha's teachings were extremely pragmatic. Why? Because that was his goal. His goal from the get-go was how do we stop the sufferings of birth, sickness, and death? Birth, sickness, old age, and death are the four. He wasn't trying to solve where we go when we die, although by focusing on what we need to get rid of to live a happy, productive, value-creating life. Those other questions became solved. But everything in Buddhism is about how to live this life well by removing the diseases of pain and misconceptions and drama and pain and tears and excessive joy and mania. All of those things are discomforts, and they're discomforts that are unique to a human life or sentient being's life. So how do I fix that? And by learning how to fix that out, by coming to the answer, it solves everything, the nature of all phenomena. So there's no need to worry about death and after death. They're just conditions of samsara, as birth is. It's moving energy. All right, back to the book. Furthermore, Subhuti, if a noble son or daughter should grasp this Dharma's teaching and memorizing it, recite it, master it, and explain it in detail to others, the Tathagata will know them, Subhuti, by means of his Buddha knowledge. And the Tathagata will see them, Subhuti, by means of his Buddha vision. The Tathagata will be aware of them, Subhuti, for all such beings produce and obtain an immeasurable, infinite body of merit. Again, this sounds like this guy has this superpower to see everybody. Remember what you just read. We just read. Buddhi is Buddhi. Buddha is the mind. And the mind is us. We all share in this mind. We all have the mind. Not my mind, not your mind. See, there's that distinction of self and other again. The mind. We all participate in the mind. And since the mind, without attachment of any sort, seeing past attachment, that's the Buddha wisdom. That's why the Buddha sees all, because it always does. It is right now. We're just covered with veils of misunderstanding and attachments. And once we can see past those, We will have the Buddha mind, the Buddha vision. We will understand everything. Will relax. We won't have extremes of emotions because emotions will cease to arise. Emotions are the product of perceptions. If we cease to have perceptions, there's nothing to be affected by. There's no emotions to arise. We just have a blissful vision while in this human form. And I can think of no other remaining sense than something of such deep compassion for those who don't get that. That's Buddhist compassion. Not you, poor person, you're starving. That's all conditions. Buddhist compassion is, how do I help you get past these perceptions that are causing you such pain? How do I teach you to let go of that? How do I see you, teach you? How do I help you? How do I facilitate you to see through all of this crud? Why do you choose to hang on to it? How can I help? That's a bodhisattva with the Buddha mind. And you feel more compelled to that compassion simply because you know your time will, as a human, will come to an end. And you will not have the opportunity after that to help others. This is the ultimate teaching of Buddhism. This is what the Hinayanas just don't get. They're all concerned about their own release. But they won't truly know full enlightenment without facilitating others at whatever level they're capable of doing it. This is the whole reason I have a web channel. This is the whole reason I've written books, that I have a website. All of this, it isn't to appease my ego. It's because I'm trying to find a way to communicate with others in a way that maybe all I do is extend their curiosity. Maybe all I do for you is point that there's an interesting book and I'd like to read it without this lunatic talking to me. I don't know how you perceive me. All of you are different. But I just want you to know my goal. My goal isn't to impress you with what I know. My goal is to make you more curious, to motivate you. This is why I'm reading from this book, because I want you to really get that this isn't just me, Sylvain, talking. There's hardly any value to that. I'm just trying to share with you an immeasurable teaching that will change your life at every level. Just starting to practice, read, study will change your life. All right, back to the book. Chapter 14. We're into it pretty good now. Subhuti is overwhelmed by this teaching. At the beginning of this sutra, when he asked the Buddha how someone could travel the bodhisattva path, he was not prepared to have journeyed so far, so soon, and is overcome by emotion. Which is itself revealing of the difference between a Shravaka and Bodhisattva path. See all that emotion? He's supposed to be the highest level of Hinayana practice, and he breaks down. Guess he hasn't really transcended his perceptions, has he? Especially as it comes from an Arhan who earlier described himself as free from passion. This is an example of what later became known as the sudden enlightenment school of Buddhism, in which emotional impact of a teaching does what meditation reflection were unable to do. See, we're going to change our karma, whether it's through the realizations of old age, or whether we get there much faster while we're still able to have a fruitful life. Although the Buddha approves, he urges Subhuti to look beyond no perceptions. Remember, perceptions, no perceptions, same thing. Lest no perceptions become a substitute for his earlier attachment to emptiness. He tells Subhuti to practice the perfection of wisdom, to practice the perfection of forbearance, to practice the perfection of charity, not with things, but with his state of mind, with what I was talking about earlier, facilitating with compassion. For only in the course of practice do no perceptions become the means by which bodhisattvas realize enlightenment and the means by which they teach other beings. Once again, the Buddha reminds Subhuti that freedom from perception by itself liberates no one. Whereas those who uphold this teaching join the lineage of teachers of humans and of gods that extends throughout the 10 directions and 3 periods of time. Chao Ming titles this detachment from form. Hui Ning says, who hears this sutra and understands its meaning awakens to what alone is real. Thus follows a chapter on detachment from form. Now, you may have heard this before. It's in Hinayana teachings. It's early teaching. It's a very fundamental teaching of Buddhism. That we come from the quiescent energy as a set of energies that, infinite amount of energies that combine to manifest, have a desire, have a tendency toward manifestation. That's karma forming. To enter the world of name and form, the samsaric condition of name and form, because names, labels refer to something other, and those other things are some form. And when you have form, you have to label it. Name and form, a duality begins the progression into manifestation. You, me, grass, universe, all of it. By the force of this Dharma, this is Shakyamuni talking, by the force of this Dharma, the venerable Subhuti was moved to tears. Wiping his eyes, he said to the Buddha, how remarkable, Bhagavan, how most remarkable, Sugata, is this Dharma teaching that the Bhagavan speaks for the benefit of those beings who seek the foremost of paths, for the benefit of those who seek the best of paths, and from which my own awareness is born. I just got it. Bhagavan, I have never heard such a teaching as this. Sorry, I just got a little emotional. Subhuti's reaction provides an example of the power of this sutra to change the life of someone whose karma has nearly run its course. Although Subhuti is an arhan and living his last life, he now realizes that there is more to the Buddha's teaching than the doctrines of emptiness, and that his cultivation of selflessness has been, ironically, selfish. He realizes that true selflessness is practiced by those who help others put an end to suffering, as the Buddha does through his teaching. How could Subhuti not be moved upon hearing such a teaching while he still has the opportunity to put it into practice? Do you see now? I mean, how could you not get? And I started from the beginning, and I'm a little over halfway. How could you not get by reading this sutra that it isn't about just losing self? That it isn't about the reality of no self? Has the words of the sutra, have that not been clear enough to say that that's an equally foolish path? No self? How could a Hinayana scholar stand up in front of thousands of people, put videos on YouTube, open up temple centers all over the world, and not be able to read this sutra correctly? It's the whole purpose of the sutra is to show Hinayana how futile their pursuit is. That's the whole